cruising down the street in my 6-4.
That ain't it.
Hello and welcome to episode 79 of Popcorn and Prosecco, a show that's all about talking about movies. I am Perry Nemiroff, and here are my co-hosts, Christy Prochko and Angie Han.
Hello.
Hi.
So this week, we are just going to have one big mishmash of a review and hot topic, and we're just going to make the whole entire show about Straight Outta Compton. So, Christy, do you want to introduce the review part first?
Yeah, because I don't know. I got nothing. here's our synopsis for Straight Outta Compton. The group NWA emerges from the mean streets of Compton in Los Angeles, California in the mid-1980s and revolutionizes hip-hop culture with their music and tales about life in the hood. This movie is produced by the surviving members of Straight Outta Compton, including Ice Cube and Dr. Dre, and it's an interesting film in a lot of respects because it's trying to tell not just the story of NWA, but also kind of the emergence of hip-hop and this group specifically. And it's interesting because I think it's a movie that is pretty well made, and in that it's dynamic and it's interesting. And even though I went in not knowing a lot about these guys and their story, because I was a kid when they were popular, I felt like I came out knowing a lot, which was exciting. And I felt really drawn into the complex narrative of their rise to fame and fortune. And remarkably, this is a movie that has a lot of actors we've never seen before, really. I mean, like, these aren't big names. We have Jason Mitchell as Eazy-E, Corey Hawkins as Dr. Dre, and O'Shea Jackson Jr. as Ice Cube, which, yeah, guys, that's Ice Cube's kid.
And they were all great,
exactly
too.
Exactly like him.
Yeah, it's kind of crazy. I love them all. Like, I walked out of this movie almost like with the biggest crushes on the three actors, and I want to see them in more movies now. But speaking to one of the points you just made about coming out having felt like you learned everything, I was actually just walking back to the apartment now, and I saw one of the big, huge billboards of the poster in Times Square, and I, like, just stopped and thought to myself, you know, I could name all five characters on that poster. And not only can I name all of them, but I can name almost all of the important supporting characters in this entire movie. And, you know, accuracy aside, I kind of have a really good idea about how this whole thing fits together. And it stuck with me, and it makes me want to, you know more about them.
Well, we'll loop back around to historical accuracy toward the end of this podcast. But for now, we're going to focus on what the movie does choose to show.
Well, I want to talk about, not about historical accuracy, but just to your point that, like, this covers not just their rise, but, like, the emergence of, like, this genre of music, and, like, it covers, like, a span of, like, several years and stuff. I almost felt like I was watching, like, it's a really good movie, it moves really fast, and it does a pretty good job, covering this, like, really wide array of topics. At the same time, there were times where I was like, I wonder if this would have been better served as, like, a 6-episode miniseries, because there's just so much to take in here.
That's a really interesting thought. I feel like I would have liked that, because while Dre, Eazy-E, and Ice Cube get a lot of attention, the other members of NWA kind of just feel like also-rans. Like, also, there's these guys,
They feel like background characters, but at the same time, I think that they were supporting characters that still made an impression. Like, I really understood what they brought to the group, at least. I didn't know them to the extent that I knew the other three, but I thought that, like, what they were was the definition of a supporting character.
Yeah, and I mean, that's the thing. It's a movie that has a clear agenda, especially because, like I said, it is produced by Ice Cube and Dr. Dre, and notably Eazy-E's widow. But I think director F. Gary Gray did a really great job in creating this kind of thriving, exciting movie that feels really accessible. Like, you know, I personally didn't, like, you know, as a kid, I didn't connect to gangster rap at all. I didn't get it. And, like, all this stuff it was super popular. It was not for me. And so I didn't really pay attention. What the film does really nicely is it contextualizes not just what gangster rap was, but where it came from, both, like, showing the police brutality that these men were facing, and also just the culture in Compton at the time. And you can really understand it. And, you know, as a kid, I didn't get all that. But the film also has to deal with the LA riots and with the Rodney King beating. And as a kid on the news, like, that all felt so far away from my reality and where I grew up, that where I was growing up, that, like, I couldn't make any sense of it. As an adult who now lives in New York, it had a profound effect on me. Especially, there's one scene where they're watching the video of the Rodney King beating on the news, and one of them says, "It's on video, that's going to make a difference." And my heart just sank because, you know, we're in 2015 and it still doesn't make a difference a lot of the time. And I think that makes the film really relevant. And I think it gives it this interesting political tinge, which is going to, I think, help it out as the year continues and we talk awards. But, and I'm not going to jump too far ahead, but I think it's going to scare the Oscars because Selma scared the Oscars. Straight Outta Compton is definitely going to scare the Oscars.
Oh, I don't even think scaring the Oscars is an issue. I just don't think that anyone's going to be talking about this in that respect in even a month once TIFF starts up. I mean, you release something in August like this, that kind of just automatically eliminates its chances, whether it's good enough or not.
It can be both. It can scare the Oscars and also just be buried under the onslaught of prestige pictures that always come toward the end of the year.
That too. Speaking of how much they cram into this movie, so I was very, very entertained from start to finish. Where it started to fall apart for me, as far as like the narrative goes, I thought all of the individual scenes played great, but in terms of how it all connected together and building upon what they already created, is when the group started to split apart. Then it started to feel a little too much. I mean, it actually speaks up to the idea of making it a series or like a mini series. Felt too much like little vignettes about every character. And it's like, we would hear, you know, like two of the guys would be like, oh, Ice Cube's talking shit about us. And then all of a sudden cut to Ice Cube. He's like, oh, they're talking shit about me now. And it's like, they're talking about each other and what they're doing affects each other, but it almost didn't feel like it was happening in the same world, you know?
Yeah, no, I think that's a very good point. And I think especially because other elements of the film are really well set up. Like, I was very surprised. I had read a little bit about their background when this film was getting made, just so I had some context when I was writing up casting stuff. And, you know, they were having some issues getting the production done. And I read up on Jerry Heller, who was the white manager played by Paul Giamatti here, who gave Eazy-E a deal and is very polarizing within the group and NWA and within hip hop history itself. And what I was very surprised by here is that Jerry Heller is a complex character too. Him and Eazy-E have a relationship that is tricky. Like, they care about each other. And I do believe that. Like, Heller's a douche and fucked him over. Absolutely. But that, you get the way they rely on each other and the way E trusts him to the point where he destroys NWA trusting someone he shouldn't. Like, I thought that was all played very beautifully here. And, like, you know, especially, like, I love Giamatti, but, like, I feel like it could have been really easy to turn Heller into some sort of cartoonishly negative, you know, money-hungry music manager, because that's just a thing we see in the movies a lot. But he managed to put a real power into the performance and to ground it in a way that not only made you look at Jerry Heller as a person, but also made you understand why E, you know, went with all that. Like, it didn't seem like he was just being duped. It seemed like he trusted this person, and you could understand why.
Yeah, there's
Paul
a lot
Giamatti
of nuance in that.
Very convincing.
He is very convincing. His wig is less convincing, but that's okay. I found the wig distracting. Anyway,
let's do a year-end list of our worst wigs, or even just hair that looks like wigs. Because
okay, if we're going to talk about the wig, it's not that it looks bad on him; it's that it's too clean and it's so obviously a wig because of it. It's like the lines are too clean, and I just found that distracting. And every time he showed up, I would be thinking about it. Fortunately, his wig doesn't have a major story arc in the movie. He does, but not his wig, so it was fine. His relationship with Eazy-E is one of the most interesting aspects of the movie, and it's one of the most interesting and complicated relationships in the movie, despite this being a film that's about, you know, the rise of this group and Jerry Heller's supporting character. But it's just, it's really interesting because I think it kind of puts in a nutshell, like, NWA's weird relationship with, like, the quote-unquote mainstream public. You know, like, you kind of see, like, these two people from two completely different worlds who kind of see things very differently, handle things very differently, and how they come together, and how it's just, it's not easy to say, oh, you know, one is just exploiting the other, and that's the end of it. Like, they do genuinely care about each other, they don't always agree, I don't know, I thought it was a really interesting relationship that they did there, and Paul Giamatti did a really good job. Like you said, he kind of turned this character into something complicated. Actually, I think you could say the same about a lot of the characters. That's one of the things I liked about this movie, is that it doesn't just simplify things to, like, you know, people are There's a lot of contradictions within the characters that I thought made them really interesting and textured. Like, one of my favorite characters in the movie was Dre, played by Corey Hawkins, and I think that he gives this really interesting performance full of contradictions where he's, like, you know, he's this, like, tough kid with a tough background, and he's, like, you know, he can be, like, hard when he needs to be, but then he also has this, like, incredible, like, he's, like, vulnerable, almost fragile, and it was just, like, a really interesting mix of traits that you don't get to see in movies that often.
I think Ice Cube had a good deal of that, too. One of my favorite parts of the movie for him was that whole part where he's trying to figure out, you know, is he being screwed over? Should he leave or not? And I think that also speaks to how excellent of a portrayal of Jerry Heller Paul Giamatti gave. I Christy, speaking to what you brought up before, like, I know nothing about Jerry Heller, so going into this, I found it really interesting how, like, I could kind of get the feeling that they're trying to set him up as the villain, but at the same time, it's like I know what he did was wrong, but at the same time, Paul Giamatti convinced me, like, of why he did it. Not that that excuses what he did by any means, but, like, I got his motivation.
Yeah, no, it makes it a lot more complicated than just, like, a simple, like, hero-villain narrative, which I think, you know, it's a really common thing that happens in a lot of musical biopics. Like, you always have, like, oh, there's this, like, rising talent, and then, like, the manager comes, like, I want to represent you, and then the manager turns out to be a dick. That's the plot of, like, literally every musical biopic, to the point where I do wonder if music managers need to hire themselves a PR person, because I feel kind of bad for them. But then this so it could have been, you know, like, you can imagine a version of this movie that's kind of, like, the cheaper, easier, lazier way of doing it, where that would have been the story arc, but they don't do that. It's really complicated. Like, I'm not comfortable saying, like, oh, Jerry Heller is just the villain of this movie, because he's really not. He's not the hero. He's not a good guy. But he's something so much more interesting and complicated than just, like, oh, the bad guy that fucked them over.
Yeah, and it's also worth pointing out that, you know, NWA arguably wouldn't be as big as they are if it weren't for him. So I don't think that's why they humanize him in the movie. I think it's because if they wanted this to be a love letter to Eazy-E, which it definitely is, then they couldn't demonize Heller outright, because then Eazy-E looks like an idiot. And I don't think that his NWA mates ultimately think he was. I think that ultimately they understood, like, in retrospect, if nothing else, why he made the decisions he made. And I think allowing that in a film makes for a better film. You know, you want characters that are flawed, because then their evolution, their growth can inspire you and can connect you. Because, you know, it's like, you know, for me, it's like you think of Unbroken last year, where you had this incredible story, this guy surviving all this stuff, but I couldn't connect to it because Angelina Jolie admired that guy so much that he just seemed like a Superman. He didn't seem like a person that I would understand. So yeah. I think that in that respect, Straight Outta Compton does a really good job.
And it does an even better job, because it's not like they're just like, you know, look at all these terrible things Eazy-E did when he was younger. They make it fit in that world. Like, he was never really a bad person. He just made stupid decisions at a point. Well, and not even necessarily stupid decisions. Like, things that someone in his position, who's just getting into the industry and really knows nothing about. I mean, he was in prime position to be taken advantage of early on, which is probably why he let Jerry into his life to that extent.
Which I think might be a good move into our second topic, which is the historical inaccuracy part. But before we move into that, is there anything else you two want to discuss about this movie?
Yeah. How good was Keith Stanfield as Snoop?
He was
he was in it for like 2 seconds.
You could have never called him,
like,
Snoop, and everybody would know who that was.
He was just so and it wasn't like, you know, they dressed him up or made him do it, like, over the top. So you're like,
yeah,
that's
like,
it was like, the voice was just so uncanny. I couldn't handle it.
And also just the languid way in which he moved his body.
And
where you were like,
he made freaking natural.
I
could not
say,
wait,
like,
to see
more
of him.
I was tweeting about this last night, but, like, Keith Stanfield's everywhere, but he's in everything for 5 minutes.
For,
he's
like,
in, like, Selma for 5 minutes. He's in Dope for 5 minutes. He's in Purge Anarchy for 5 minutes. He's in this for 5 minutes. I'm so glad he's getting work, but I'm like, someone please put him in a fucking movie for more than 5 minutes.
And until someone puts him in that big movie with a big role, just go rewatch Short Term 12, because he's fantastic in that.
Which is on Netflix.
Ah,
Short Term 12.
All right, so
maybe someone should make
the
Snoop Dogg spinoff, you know? Turn this into the Straight Outta Compton cinematic universe.
Oh, I don't really know much about Snoop's real backstory, but I think I would watch that.
I would support it just because it would mean that Keith Stanfield would get to be in something for more than 5 minutes. He's almost turning into, like, the male Judy Greer. She's like, oh, you're here. Goodbye.
There's something sad but, like, fine about that, even though I think he deserves more. I admire Judy Greer.
They both deserve more.
She just rocks every movie. I was just watching. Oh, I'm going to get off topic. All right. Hot topic. Real stuff, please.
Angie's going to lead us off with this.
All right, so as happens with, well, pretty much any biopic, really, there's been some talk about the historical inaccuracies in the movie, and the thing that people have taken the most issue with is the way this movie deals with women, or rather doesn't. Like, one major omission is, Dre notoriously beat the shit out of this journalist named Dee Barnes, like, back in the day, like, during the course of the events that are covered in this movie, which is just not even alluded to in the movie. And then on top of that, there are some, like, female collaborators or, like, women who are otherwise important to these men in positive or negative ways, you know, during the events that are depicted in this movie that are not mentioned. Like, the only female characters you get in this movie at all are either, nice wives and girlfriends who are in it, or moms who are in it for, like, 5 minutes, or just, you know, scantily clad or even completely naked women at parties, in party scenes.
Groupies that generally don't have lines and have less clothes.
And are sometimes, you know, there's this one scene, the Bye Felicia scene. Like, you know, we all know, like, oh, Bye Felicia, it's like a famous line. And this movie kind of has, like, a miniature origin story for that line. And in this movie's version, in this movie's telling, it's Felicia was, like, some, you know, groupie that was giving Ice Cube a blowjob, and that, like, you know, her boyfriend came looking for her, and he just kind of, like, shoved her out of the hotel hallway just completely naked. It's, like, kind of a,
and
it's
said,
a really
bye,
ugly
Felicia.
Moment. Yeah, exactly. It's a really ugly moment. I don't know. It's a complicated topic because there's just so, I don't know.
No, yeah, here.
It's just an enormous thing to,
I think you laid down the groundwork really well. I think, first off, there's a certain degree where you think it makes sense because they are trying to stay focused on a narrative. So mentioning all these collaborators, there aren't just female collaborators that were left out. There are male collaborators too. So I get some of these exclusions. However, the Dee Barnes thing, Straight Outta Compton, the movie, spends a lot of time focusing on the battle between NWA and Ice Cube after he left, and the way they were dissing each other and the way they were engaging in each other. And Dee Barnes, she was at the center of that in a way that really was not fair. Basically, she had interviewed Ice Cube and he said some shit about NWA, and Dre heard about it and saw her at a party and attacked her. And not only attacked her, followed her when she tried to run away and continued to attack her. So it's not that. And Dee Barnes has written about this on Gawker, and I highly recommend reading it because she not only tells her side of the story, but talks about how she feels like this could or should have been represented. And she basically says, like, look, I don't want to see that in the movie. That's too ugly for general audiences. But she makes the point that the film very articulately connects how police brutality affected these young men and how they channeled that into their art. But it chooses to ignore how that anger and that violence also channeled into how they treated women and how kind of the flow of that violence and the negative impact that has. So the movie chose not to be about that. And I'm with Angie in being torn because I understand on a couple of levels why you don't include this. One, I don't think you could show Dre beating Dee Barnes and still root for him.
Well, they have, okay, I mean, you like, if you separate Dre the character from Dre the real person, like, Dre the character in here feels like a fully formed person. The movie has a really good idea of who Dre the character, the fictionalized character in the movie, is, and this Dee Barnes thing just wouldn't fit into that narrative. I mean, is that, like, kind of a messed up choice? Maybe?
Exactly.
The other weird,
and it's
the,
like,
other thing
especially
that comes into play here is, like, this is, like, the rare movie that's about black men who are not historically the subject of many, like, fawning musical biopics, you know, not like this. And hip-hop is something that, like, it has a complicated history with sexism and misogyny and women, and it's just, I mean, I don't know. I worry sometimes that you know, we get this like fantastic movie about young black men, and I don't want to derail the conversation by being just like, oh, but like, what about women? But then on the other hand, it feels weird that they got left out. And ultimately, the conclusion I came to is that the real problem, I mean, I think that these are very, very valid criticisms that, you know, this movie is not good about women. But I think what it comes down to in a lot of ways is just that the biggest problem here is that this is the only movie that we're going to get about this, that we have almost ever gotten about this and probably will in the near future. I think there's a lot of pressure for Straight Outta Compton to cover everything that happened in that period, because how often do we ever see any mainstream entertainment about, you know, the rise of gangster rap?
To connect it to something that we've discussed on the show before, Angie, you previously connected Straight Outta Compton to Black Widow in saying that because Black Widow is one of the very few female characters in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, what she does and how she is portrayed means a lot more because she's basically carrying an entire gender on her back.
She has to be all things to all people. Like, she bears a burden of representation, and I think in part that's kind of why this controversy over the movie's portrayal of women is blown up. Because, like, let's point out, like, you know, historical biopics about people of any gender or race, they always leave out some unsavory things. That's not unusual. But I think one of the reasons that this movie is getting so much flack for that is because this is the one time that anyone's ever decided to make a big movie about this topic, and it hurts to kind of not see some things that were really important to some people portrayed in this.
It's also strange because, and some people pointed out, the interview that was the birth of this Rage Dre focused at Dee Barnes, director F. Gary Gray was there. He was the cameraman. So He's tangled in. It's just very interesting. I don't know that there's an answer to it. I think it is strange in that they left it out of the movie also because Dre acts so repulsed by the violence Suge Knight has in the movie.
I think that's probably partly why they kept it out, though, because if you then show Dre being a violent person, like, as a character, it wouldn't fit. It would make no, the narrative would not make any sense. It's the kind of thing that makes sense in real life.
I think that actually, I mean, this is me like tweaking the script and maybe there's no point in doing this, but if they had included the fight with Dee Barnes before the Suge Knight scene, like, he could have done something bad, seen someone else do something that he just did, and been like, fuck, look what just happened to me.
Yeah. That's a good point. That would have been interesting.
Like I brought up before, I'm someone who doesn't really know very much about, like, all the history behind this. Like, I knew NWA and I liked all their songs and all that, but I don't really know what went on behind closed doors. So when I sat down for this movie and just watched the movie, like, I just sat there and just saw what I saw on screen, the way that they portrayed women didn't register to me whatsoever. I mean, I think that I got
the
story.
Well, they're barely in it.
They're barely in it.
How,
like,
hip-hop was at the time.
I saw the story that I wanted to see on screen as far as entertainment value goes. Mm-hmm. However, after coming out of it and reading up on the Dee Barnes story and what happened, you know, you kind of can't help but to question whether or not it's right or wrong to leave something that instrumental out.
Yeah,
but at the same time,
Dr. Dre
is a producer on this movie, so for all we know, there could have been something in his contract. You know, I will back you, but this can't be in it.
Well, there was actually a draft of the script that had the scene. You can actually find that online. It's on IndieWire and Vulture, I know. It's one of those things where it's like, I think that the filmmakers had the right to tell the story they wanted to tell. If they wanted to leave this out, they are more than welcome to leave it out. I do think it's also our right to have the conversation about what does that mean. And yeah, I'm torn because I came out of Straight Outta Compton feeling one way, and then I read Dee Barnes' piece, and now I'm conflicted. And it's interesting. My bigger issue, though, and I do think it's separate from the Dee, maybe not bigger issue, the Bi Felicia thing I think is troubling in that it makes light of the abuse of women and the sexualizations of women in a way that the movie absolutely did not need for a throwaway joke.
Completely.
And it's not even accurate. Like, F. Gary Gray has said that it was an improv on the set that they thought would be funny because it refers to Friday.
Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, it's all connected, but it's slightly separate. Like, even when you look past the stuff that they omitted, the few depictions that they leave in of women and the way that these characters treat women, are still not overwhelmingly positive.
With one exception, which we pointed out.
With one exception, which is Eazy-E's wife, Tamika Woods, right? Who happens to be a producer on the movie.
So I guess that maybe is the lesson that they maybe didn't mean to make, but if you want to be treated as a person, you have to get on the same level as megastars. I don't know.
I think the lesson is if you're a person that's historically been marginalized, it's hard to get your voice out there unless you're the one making the movie. That's actually the lesson that I would take away from the fact that Tamika is the only female character that's actually treated well in this movie.
That's a very good point. I don't know how we could wrap that up better, honestly.
Wow, I'm honored.
Yeah, I think you nailed it. Yeah, it's a complicated issue, but guys, I'm really glad we talked about it today.
And all these issues aside, the movie itself, really fun. Go watch it. It's really entertaining, and even if you don't think you know about this genre of music, you will sit there and be like, oh my god, I remember this song! Yeah, and it'll be exciting. Or at least really I have that
experience. And accessible. Then you will likely go home and have to download, you know, quite a bit of it, which I might have done. And this is also a movie that I genuinely want to watch again.
This was your soundtrack to moving into your new place?
A little, yeah. There was a little bit of that.
You guys may have noticed that Perry's got new digs behind her.
I know. What? I have like a proper setup now. I'm not like huddled in my bedroom. I actually like have posters and like nice decoration. Oh, it's very nice. Deputy Dewey approves.
Yeah. All thanks right, thanks for waiting me to get back from vacation so we could really dig into Straight Outta Compton, guys.
Absolutely. So that is a wrap on episode 79 of Popcorn and Prosecco. We would love for you to go over to iTunes and subscribe to the podcast, and then also comment and rate us there. We have a website, popcornprosecco.com. We are on Facebook, where you can like us. We are on Twitter, @PopcornProsecco. We also have our YouTube channel, and then all three of us are all over the internet as well. Christy, you want to take it first?
Yeah, you can find me @ChristyPuchko on Twitter, and I write all over the interwebs, but you can find my career highlights at decadentcriminals.com. Angie's laughing because she did mine last week on
that
point.
That's exactly why I'm laughing. I'm sitting here laughing because I'm like, oh, I did such a good job of being
you nailed it.
Last
I watched last week and I was like, well done.
But you can also find me on Twitter. I am @AJHAN and I write for slashfilm.com.
And you can catch my writing on collider.com and my Twitter handle is @PNemiroff. Next week, you know what we should do? We should rotate and we should all say each other's thing.
I was just thinking
and
that.
See who is the closest. So tune in next week for that. And thank you for joining us this week. Go see Straight Outta Compton. Have a good one, guys.
They want NWA? Let's give them NWA. Straight Outta Compton.